this week on the Eldritch Lorecast.
Let's start with this question. What are we doing here?
Oh, I want to turn into an animal of the land.
Why are the spell levels different from the character levels? Well, it's because we've artificially divided 10 levels into 20.
So the people out there who are like, oh, having a short combat in the middle of a long rest shouldn't interrupt the long rest. All right, I don't know if you've ever had to get up at 2 a.m. to do battle with a huntsman.
Player character of the land.
I played a bard and I rolled on my dice in a tambourine.
I was in the digital age before you were born, son.
All that and more? Right. Now!
3, 2, 1, here we go.
Ben, I'm cleaning my glasses. Wait! Wait, whoa! Ben! Wait! Wait!
3, 2, 1. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of the Eldritch Lorecast, the number one tabletop RPG podcast in all the realms, your number one source of tabletop news, at least for another couple of weeks, if not months. I'm not sure. We'll find out. My name's Ben Byrne.
Are we in danger? I'm here.
What?
No, because I meant there was another the tabletop news network thing that we talked about last week. Anyway.
Right, sure.
My name's Ben Byrne, and I am here, as always, with Dale Kingsmill, Sean Merwin, James Hake. James... physical or digital dice? And I'm not just asking for yourself. If you are the GM or you are at a table, do you trust somebody else using the other type of dice?
To answer that question, yes. Yes, I trust my players not to cheat with their dice rolls. Whatever, it's fine. We're here to have a good time. Even if they do cheat a little bit, honestly, I don't. It doesn't bother me. Not very much. Not unless they're doing it all the time and obviously. Gotcha. I'll give it to them if they can be a very sort of sly cheater about it.
If they can get away with it, it's fine.
Yeah. But here's my answer. I vastly prefer physical dice, but I 90% of the time use digital dice. And it's because so many of my games right now are digital. I play on my desk, and if you could see my desk right now, it's a war zone. There's bills everywhere, tax season's coming up, so I've got tax papers all over the place. There's Barnes & Noble gift cards shoved into weird little nooks and crannies.
Yeah, I got Benadryl, a passport, a tarot deck.
So, like, I have dice right here. I've got, you know, really nice, sort of heavy, clunky, copper, beautiful dice. There's nowhere to roll the damn things. Right. So I'm just like, I'll just say, because Google has a pretty good dice roller these days. I just say dice roller into Google and it's got every type of basic polyhedral. And I just use that.
Okay. The reason I asked this question is last night I finally got my wife onto D&D Beyond because she really struggles with game rules. She often forgets her character's abilities and what they can do because it's scribbled on her character sheet in 7 different places. And so finally, we should have done this 3 years ago, but finally I was like, all right, you need to make a new character. Let's do it in D&D Beyond. And she clicked through. She made it herself effortlessly. She was like, this is way better. And my heart sang because I was like, yes, now she's managed to access the game in a way that she wasn't previously able to access it before. And she's like, I can even roll all my dice in here. This is what I'll do from now on. And my heart sank because I definitely prefer physical dice. Dale Kingsmill, do you have the same predilection? Dale Kingsmill is muted.
Maybe I just didn't want to talk to you, Ben. Did you ever think about that? No, I definitely am team physical dice. I like the clicky clacky rocks. I have a desk like James's, but like my keyboard is pushed all the way away from me so that I have a little scooped out section where I can roll dice because I prefer it that much more. There's no logical reason for it. I saw this banter on Twitter recently. I saw it. But I don't know. I like doodling on my sheet and I have all my little shorthands that I can't do digitally. And that's different from dice, but it's still, it's, you know, like little stars on things to tell me to remember to roll with advantage and things like that. I will always be a physical gal.
No, that's fair enough. I am willing to trust D&D Beyond now, not just because of the debate between Abrea and Brennan, but because I don't know if you saw Amy Dallin's response,
it was,
I think,
so
on
good.
Twitch. Not Twitch, sorry, TikTok. Yeah, it was really good. And I'm like, all right. Well, I just got to make sure she's got a big enough computer screen and she can roll all the dice she wants. Sean Merwin, have you moved into the digital age or are you rolling the physical dice?
I was in the digital age before you were born, son. So I love to see the dice being rolled, which means if I'm playing digitally, I want to see via Roll20, via D&D Beyond, whatever tool we're using, I want to see those dice roll. Mm-hmm. If we're at the table, I want to see those dice roll. This may have been even third edition. I was at a convention running a game and someone insisted to roll on their laptop. And mm-hmm. everyone was like, sure, go ahead. And I swear this person rolled their dice, hit a button, and we heard the sad trombone sound. and he went, that's a 37. And we were all like, no, we heard the sad trombone sound. That was a natural one. And you know it. Don't make us come over there. So my mistrust of digital stuff has gone away. And I fully embrace our new digital overlords.
Your mistrust of digital stuff has been replaced with a healthy mistrust for people.
Yeah. I've always had that.
Do conventions, I haven't found this to be the case. We did an online convention a couple of years ago where we used, I think it's Avray, is it, in Discord? Mm-hmm. And you just type in attack and it automatically generates something for you. And we had that kind of as a policy of the convention that we were going to use Avray so that everybody's dice rolls could be seen. The only people that were immune to that was the game masters themselves. Do in-person conventions tend to dictate whether you're allowed to use digital or physical dice one way or the other? Or it's just like, whatever, we're all here to have fun.
I think it's usually whatever the player wants to do, whatever the game master chooses or insists upon is how it goes. But anymore, you'll have people fully digital except for their dice at the table, or fully, pen and paper, but on their phone, they do their dice rolling. It all depends on what people are most comfortable with badly they need to cheat.
I have a follow-up question, Ben, if you'll allow it.
Please.
Because I realize as I grab for the closest dice set to me.
Like I'm in charge here.
My gracious host. The closest dice set to me are these like copper dice. They've got a pretty good heft to them. And I wanted to ask y'all's opinions on heavy dice. Because as it turns out, having used these dice, I actually don't like heavy dice very much. The heft is actually a little off-putting to me. And I don't know if you'll be able to hear this through the mic, but when I roll it on this desk, it sounds like this.
Whoa. Mm-hmm. Mm. That is just some heft.
It's just loud and beefy, and it's not very conducive to playing online via microphone. Maybe if I had like a dice tray with like a nice sort of leather rolling surface, I could, and I were playing in person, it would be this charming sort of ba-bum. This deep bassy beautifulness, but no.
I don't know why that just reminded me of when I played a bard and I rolled on my dice in a tambourine instead of a dice tray. I like that. I'm sure that was really funny for everyone else the whole time. But I have found myself quite liking hefty dice. I don't like dice that are non-standard sizes. I don't know, that's my thing that just inexplicably bugs me is dice that are too big or too small.
Mm. What about weirdly shaped?
I'm kind of fine with that.
When those metallic dice first came out, many people ended up ruining their dining room tables without realizing exactly how hefty and what sort of force those could be launched into a piece of wood with. Yeah.
The ones I don't like, I don't know if you've seen them a lot, but I've seen one player with them once, is the D20 that's a ring and you just like spin the ring. Yeah. I'm not sure I trust that because all the numbers are like, I don't know, in order, I suppose, not randomly around an object. Does that make sense? I'm not a mathematician. Speaking of odds, let's go through the quick news first and then we'll dive into the long news.
You really
news.
Just fully turned away from that segue. There was simply no segue that occurred.
Well, it's odd because we're not getting into the big news first because I feel like the rest of this stuff will be rapid fire.
Right. See, that was bad, but it was a segue. That's what we've come to expect.
Speaking of that, screw it.
I just found this out.
You're in the wars today, Ben. You're in the wars today.
I know. Just a beleaguered substitute teacher. I'm having flashbacks to 3 years ago. look, on this lesson, we've got a lot of work to get through. First of which being that Matt Mercer is going to be DMing for the next season of Dimension 20. I saw the second clip. Did you not see this, Dale? I assume you would have been all over this.
Exciting. Yeah.
Their Twitter released as much as everyone else does now.
Yay.
Basically. All right, moving on. Baldur's Gate 3 has a release date, which is August 31st. It's coming to PC, Mac OS, and PS5 on the same day.
Can I just say very briefly on this topic, when I had the air conditioning people in my home, they saw this streaming setup and they were very excited about it. And they asked what I did. And I said, oh, I make D&D stuff. And they said, oh, cool. Like, what kind? And I was like just D&D. And they were like, yeah, but like Baldur's Gate or... And I said, no. We need to get much nerdier. We're talking polyhedral dice.
Yeah, not digital dice specifically.
Yeah. I've never played a Baldur's Gate game.
Me neither. James?
So I've never played a Baldur's Gate game either, but I have been playing some Divinity Original Sin 2, which is Larian Studios' post-Baldur's Gate spiritual successor, basically. And then Wizards commissioned them to make Baldur's Gate 3, right? Mm. So it's kind of a part of the tradition of Western CRPGs, and it's fun. It's fun. It's not my genre. I'm much more of a like JRPG, strategy RPG, Fire Emblem-y sort of guy, Final Fantasy Fire Emblem, that sort of thing. But but I am having fun. I like how malleable the story is. I think that's really the selling point of games like this. Whereas in my mind, at least, you're playing a Japanese role-playing game. You're there to watch the characters do cool things and kind of enjoy the plot as it happens. And in a Western RPG, it's much more choice-driven in its best form.
Sure.
So I'm hoping that Baldur's Gate 3 has a lot of that, because if I get a new PC that can actually run it in the next year or so, I'll definitely play it.
Is it intensive? I didn't assume so looking at it, but maybe it is.
Yeah, it's probably got some pretty serious particle effects that if I turned them all off, it would run just fine, but... I want to get the full game experience. I haven't played, you know, fresh PC games on the hardware they're intended for, like, ever in my life. I kind of want to.
And I'll probably go for PS5. I didn't realize they were going to be bringing this out on consoles. But not only are they bringing it out on consoles, it's also split-screen co-op. So if you really...
like the olden days.
Like the, yeah, flashback in time.
I miss split-screen co-op. I won't lie.
Yeah, it was good. That was the way I played Halo back in the day.
Same with my brother on Legendary.
Yeah, got to get through. So just seeing your little heat HUD thing down in the corner just be all red while you're in a room and panicking. It was great. It was great.
Perfection.
Sean Merwin, are you excited for Baldur's Gate 3?
I am, if I'm allowed to. Definitely excited about it. I played the Baldur's Gate games back when they first came out on PC, and they were... one of the first times that D&D was brought to, you know, digital in a way that actually felt like you were actually playing the game.
Yeah.
And so that was cool. I replayed the original Baldur's Gate when it was ported to iPad and iOS. And so that was fun. My daughter and I, we played Divinity from Larian, as James mentioned. We had a great time playing that. If they can meld those two things and do even a halfway decent job at it, they're going to have at least two fans who are ready to sit down and have some D&D fun.
Yeah, Dante keeps trying to put together a Baldur's Gate crew among us here, and I want to have more enthusiasm for it than I do. I'm sorry, Dante. I know he's listening to this conversation. It's literally his job right now. But I just, when I was asked, I was like, I don't know. I think I'd rather, you know, if I'm going to commit like an evening, play D&D. But that says, I think I'm being overly pessimistic.
I've been looking at the chat and there's a lot of Baldur's Gate lovers in the chat. I think that early access thing that Larian has been doing has really threaded the needle on making the community extremely excited. Early access is hard to do well, but when you do it well, like it looks like Larian has, you get some really dedicated fans. So I think BG3 is going to have a lot of like community and community hype right when it launches, kind of in the way, honestly, the 5e had because of its D&D Next playtest when it actually launched. It's going to make it, really going to buoy it. And I'm excited. I want this game to succeed because it legitimately looks great.
Hench on the Bench is also making a good point. It's got some voice acting chops. J.K. Simmons is voicing the villain in it. And I liked what it, the article that I read was like J.K. Simmons from Spider-Man. And it was like some other voice acting gig that they like, Cave you know, credited from. And I was like,
you take the lemons.
He's been in so many things, you know. Whiplash. Is Whiplash, is that the name of the movie where he's the drummer guy?
Are you rushing?
Yeah. That's what I look forward to, playing Baldur's Gate 3, is him going like, do you have any spell slots left or do you have too many spell slots? Tell me, which one is it? And then him getting angry at me.
Ben, you mentioning Whiplash made me think back to when me and my college roommate would get into arguments. Whenever we got into an argument over some mundane little thing in our apartment.
You'd throw a chair at your head? Gee, well, man, that's pretty intense.
Whenever things would start to get a little heated for no good reason, one of us, it started out as him and then it eventually became both of us, would say, were you rushing? Or were you dragging? And then we would both just crack up and everything was instantly forgotten. Because it's like, what the hell are we arguing about here?
Sean, what is your favorite D&D monster?
Really?
Is this about to be another Ben's Merch Corner?
No. Yeah. No, maybe.
My favorite D&D monster, I would have to say at this point, is the vampire.
But if you had to pick one from the monster manual that was from the M section, what would it be?
I since it's my last name, I would have to go with the mimic. The mimics are
really
awesome. Yes.
Well, how can I interest you in a WizKids life-size mimic for your Dungeons and Dragons room, and it's only going to set you back $375 dues plus delivery
US
and handling. US
dollary dues.
So here's the thing about that.
I don't think they have dollary dues in the US.
We do not. We don't. And we're getting fewer and fewer
between
of them.
Dollars and dollary dues.
Yes. As far as I know, I may actually already have a mimic somewhere in my gaming space, and I just don't know it. So I'm not going to spend the $375 because I may already have one and I don't want to.
Yeah. Gotcha.
I think the US equivalent is buckaroonies. Yeah.
Okay, gotcha.
In fact, I'll sell you something that could be a mimic right behind me for $300.
Yeah. Okay, all right. Yeah. That's a saving.
So is it a statue or is it like a chest? Like, can you store things in it?
Nah.
Oh.
Nah, this is designed to build atmosphere to you know, you can store anything in a chest, but a mimic, that's going to eat your face off. No, not convinced. All right, James,
you can store your face in it.
What's your favorite D&D monster that starts with M and ends in C?
Listen, Ben. If you say starts with M, I'm gonna defy whatever sort of setup you've got going for you and say Mind Flayer. Obviously the best M starting monster in the Monster Manual.
But what if it has to end in C?
A Mind Flayer.
Yeah, okay. Mind Flayer.
Well, WizKids can also sell you a Mind Flayer head, which you could mount on your wall. Very I'm sure. True. In all seriousness, has anybody here indulged in such hefty purchases for the sake of decorating a room, or are these really targeted at game stores that nobody visits anymore?
I know a couple of people, but most of them are D&D professionals who have these things.
Gotcha.
I don't know if this is an inside baseball product.
Statues of Drizzt.
Oh, God, the life-size Drizzt statue.
The life-size Drizzt statue, yeah. There are, people must be buying these. Because they keep making them.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's true. So, I really liked, this isn't technically D&D, but back when Geek & Sundry had their Magic the Gathering show, they just had like a mannequin in the background dressed in Jace cosplay. And it looked really cool. That's the closest I would get. Mm-hmm. Plus, I'd get a creepy mannequin out of the deal, which is nice.
That would be nice.
I think the creepy mannequin would be more exciting for you, Dale.
Also, just useful, versatile, great around Halloween.
Use it for anything.
Yeah. Mm,
someday when I'm a rich, rich RPG designer.
Do they exist?
Yeah. I was gonna stab that dagger in, but you took it out of my hand, Dale. The Valakan Clans Kickstarter is still ongoing. And last week, we released a video on the Ghostfire Gaming main YouTube channel. If you just search Ghostfire Gaming, you'll find it, which is a raiding gameplay trailer. So it shows off how the raiding system for Raider's Guide to Valakar kind of functions practically. We had Maddie P, friend of the channel, kind of helping bring that to life with Meek. And it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of stress for Dante as we filmed basically 2 hours of us doing this raid. And then he had to figure out how to cut it into what I said was a 25-minute video. It turned out to be 33 minutes. But 33 minutes packed with raiding and fun. So
my many years on YouTube has taught me that no matter what you think you're going to be able to cut the video down to, it will always be at least half minutes. The length of the footage. At least half the length of the footage.
All right, I'll remember that as a rule of thumb to go from now on. Cool, so go check that out. The Kickstarter is still ongoing, and there's a link in the chat, and there'll be links in the places where links exist. That was better than last week, right? Six out of ten, 7 out of 10. Yeah, all right, yeah. Great. All right, let's dive in. The 1D&D playtest packet has dropped. This, I suspect, may take up the rest of the episode, depending on how deep we want to dive here. I'm going to throw it over. Where do we want to start? What jumps out at us?
Let's start with this question. What are we doing here? If you are going to design something, you really should be designing toward goals. And we need to know what those goals are. Are they going to make the game more streamlined? Are they going to make character creation easier? Or are they going to make it more complicated to give more, you know, more heft to the choices that you make? All of those are wonderful goals. We as the consumers need to know, what are the goals of this game? Why are these changes being made? Mm. And until we hear what those goals are, making the game better doesn't mean anything, right? Mm. We need to know. And then we can, as designers or as fans, say, okay, cool, I'm behind this. Let's go. Let's see how this is going to work. Until we hear otherwise, then all we're really seeing is moving pieces around. Mm. It's not changing the game loop. It's not making things easier, harder, streamlined, less streamlined. It's not doing any of those things. So until, you know, people are like, hey, let's discuss this. And I'm like, yeah, I'd love to, but really all we're doing is tweaking this and that and the other, and it's hard to get a good sense of direction until we know.
Yeah, there is a sense of we're just moving the furniture around. And sometimes you move the furniture around, now the feng shui is all off, as with this druid. I've been chatting with friends about this a lot this week, particularly with the absolute vomitous mouthful, animal of the land. I'm going to transform into an animal of the land.
I'm sorry, vomitous mouthful? Awful. How dare you put that phrase in my mind?
You should be a writer. That's very descriptive.
You know, there's actually a lot of things I like about what they've done with the very controversial changes to the druid. I like the idea of having some kind of generic stat blocks you can use kind of imagine any animal you want to on it. But I do wish that we were able to still turn into Monster Manual monsters or Monster Manual beasts, in addition to having a kind of catch-all animal, or, you know, call it like a combat form, call it the, you know, the druidically enhanced, I don't know. These are terrible names. I shouldn't be a writer.
Druidically enhanced.
It looks like what they're trying to do here with the druids specifically, and they've kind of like, there's a lot of little changes that when you read the rule at face value, you're like, oh, that's the same. But then when you sort of drill down a little bit more, you're like, oh, okay, I see why this is different from what it was before. And I can imagine, I don't know if they've done a video on this packet yet. I know they did one kind of talking about the previous survey, but I can imagine Jeremy Crawford saying something to the effect of, this druid is much more in line with where we intended the druid to go with 5e's design, because he said that about a few other things that they've put into this packet. But the criticisms of the old druid was that it could turn into anything, so a DM kind of had to be prepared for anything. It could just turn into an octopus in the middle of a battle and sort of grapple everything up. It could tank damage arguably better than barbarians could, because you just turn into a massive bag of hit points and the GM has to get through all of that first before they even get back to having to deal with you as a wizard. And then you could transform into something else immediately after if you wanted to. And it also took the role of the rogue, because it could turn into a spider, or it could turn into like something small and hide and get under doorways and stuff like that. And you can see that instead of just allowing you to whole hog transform into any animal, they've tried to really stretch out kind of the narrative of when you have to wait till certain things.
What level is it? Like level 10 or something before you can turn into
a tiny creature? Yeah, it's level 11.
I see what they're doing. I see this stat block. I appreciate what they're going for. I don't know if I like what they're going for. It feels like it really is... It's showing that they're driving in a different direction to this sort of asymmetrical design that they really went hard with in 5e. And I get that. But at the same time, I think that okay, here's what it is. I'm starting to figure out what has had me underwhelmed with so many of these 5.5 class designs is that there's nothing in there that I read and I go, oh, awesome, I want to do that. You know, like, I don't look at this druid and go, oh, I want to turn into an animal of the land, you know, whereas selling that fantasy of the versatility of that sort of animorphsy, you know, like, yeah, you could turn into a mouse to infiltrate this place, or you could, you know, turn into a bird and do recon, or you could turn into a bear and join the fight. That versatility is a great fantasy to sell. That's exciting conceptually. So then the question becomes, how do you balance that? And I see the direction they've gone. I don't love it. I mean, like, I altered the wild shape and how it worked when I did my fever dream rewrite of everything. I do think that it needed some reworking because it could do everything so well. But even like, I mean, I'm not convinced that it would work necessarily, but like one of the ideas that I was instantly excited about when I read it was someone on Reddit saying, what if they had the wild shapes work more like Eldritch Invocations, right? Like you have to pick, you have to actually go, I want to be able to, you know, get into the fray in combat, so I have chosen the bear, or I want to infiltrate, so I have chosen the spider, you know, any number of things, but you have to like actually expend choices on those things, which as well adds to that animorphy thing.
Yeah.
Bill, this is very in line with what I've been thinking of, because Ben, I agree with you that there are two big points that they want to address with the druid. And one is related to balance, especially at low levels where the Circle of the Moon druid is ridiculously durable at low levels and kind of underwhelming at high levels. So flatten it out a little bit. And also that they want to make the game more accessible to new players and make it easier to run on a digital platform, right? Those are the two simplicity goals that they want to do.
Which note that having a single like animal of the land stat block that is always the same no matter what you turn into is very digital friendly.
Yeah,
yes. For sure. I think that if I were in charge of this, there I would do two things that would solve those two problems. And Dale, you're right on the money with make them discrete choices. Don't give you access to all beasts of under a certain level. In Xanathar's Guide, they kind of try to massage this idea into being of, if you're from the forest, these are animals that you would have seen, because you need to have seen an animal to wild shape into it. Here are the ones you would know as a druid from the forest. Here are ones you would know of a druid from the desert, et cetera, et cetera. Just have it be like, you know, spells known. Forms known. Just know a bunch of animals. You get to choose three at first level because you've, you know, made some sort of totemic attunement to them or something like that. Make it so that you've imbued some spiritual magic into yourself, into the animal form. And also, when you transform, keep your hit points the same as a druid and just give yourself a burst of temporary HP. Don't transform all of a sudden into a 50 hit point bear that you got to slog through before you're back, and then transform again into another 50 hit point bear and then you're done for the day. Don't do that.
I think the big thing here is they are trying to make this more accessible for digital platforms. I don't think they're making this any more accessible for people that are new to the game. I don't know whether it's just me because I've already, like, 5e is in my bones, and so I want to think in 5e almost like learning a new language, so it seems complicated. But it just seems like with all this keywording, of, you know, magic actions and not magic actions and what constitutes as an expert class and what, you know, this, that, and the other. It actually just feels like it's becoming more convoluted, or at least definitely not simpler to understand, because there's more terms and things that a new player might have to keep into their head.
I think the Paladin got a nerf.
I think that the Paladin's a little OP originally anyway.
That's the thing. I think the Paladin got a nerf and I'm happy about it.
Yeah.
You know, it did get the ability to smite on range.
Yeah.
That's good. I've wanted to do that since D&D Next.
And unarmed strikes.
And unarmed strikes? Awesome. I think, you know, having...
You could before, because an unarmed strike was just a weapon attack.
You could. It was one of those things where it's like anyone reading the rules would assume that you could, but Crawford came in and said no, it got complicated.
Yeah. Unarmed strikes have been clarified to not be weapon attacks in Sage Advice, which I do think is a little silly. But anyway, we've resolved that. There's two things that really got nerfed on the Paladin. One being one smite per turn, and the other being, and this is a lesser thing, there's no bonus damage on fiends and undead anymore.
I noticed that as well. Here's the other thing, just quickly. You can't stack your smites anymore because you can't smite on a turn that you cast a spell. So you can't cast brandishing smite or whatever smite you want to cast. And then when you hit the creature, stack another spell slot on top of it for even more damage.
Yeah. So its Nova potential is a lot lower, which I think is generally a good thing.
What does this do, though, to people? We on the power gamer side of things, who the only reason we played a Paladin was we could give a +4/+5 to all our friends on their saving throws, which saved us so many times. And I could do this Nova smite thing, especially if I critted. And that's why I played this. That was the fun for me. Oh, now they're taking that away. What are they giving other people to make them want to play this class now? Is it just the you know, the grandeur of being this knight in shining armor? Is that enough to carry the class?
It looks like a rogue, right? It looks like a rogue via a different avenue in a way.
Explain.
Tell me more about this.
Well, you can only smite once per turn. So even if a rogue multi-classes to get multi-attack, they can still only sneak attack once per turn. So it feels like you get that one good attack that you really like. And then the next attack is like, it's like an offhand attack. It's like, yeah, it'll do some damage, but it's not reason I've chosen this class.
Am I remembering wrong? It's such a long time ago now. Is the new rogue only able to sneak attack once per round now instead of once per turn?
Oh.
Which
I think it was still once per turn. Been a while.
It was still once per turn. I hope it was still once per turn.
Once per round would be very sad. Very sad for rogues.
So I'm not a player who's ever especially looked at Paladins and gone, I want to play that. But I have looked at Paladins and gone, that is very cool. And I feel like for a new player who doesn't play Paladins, coming in and looking at this set of classes available, I think you would still look at the Paladin and think it's one of the cool options. You know what I mean? I think it's still got a bit of oomph to it. I will note that, as with every other class in these playtest packets, very unfortunately, you get to the second half of the class and everything kind of drops off and there's nothing new, nothing exciting happening. And I think that's a real shame, because at that point, why are we even doing 20 levels? If you're not going to do 20 levels of cool stuff. I mean, look, this is... Well, seeing the last subclass thing happen at level 14 made me inexplicably so sad, because... I don't know why you wouldn't, even if most players don't reach level 20, there's this awesome aspirational quality of the level 20 feature. Here's your capstone. It's meant to encapsulate this subclass, this class. Here's something awesome for you to aspire to, even though you'll probably never reach it. And we're not doing that anymore. And we're also not getting much in the latter half of the class anyway. So at that point, just make it a 10-level game.
I do think that the 10-level game would be much better, and it would solve this whole nonsense of 9th-level spells that we get our knickers in a twist over every year. Why are the spell levels different from the character levels? Well, it's because we've artificially divided 10 levels into 20, and that's the answer.
But am I correct in saying that every level in this new playtest packet, in theory, gives you something? Because if you look at the chart for the druid, it's like no new level thing, which is common for spellcasters because the idea is that they're getting access to more and more spells as they go along.
Mm-hmm.
And the marshals tend to get more something new each level, even if that's just an ability score improvement. Whereas this feels like it's like, no, every level you unlock some.
Yeah, but it feels like a Christmas
thing.
Advent calendar, yeah. Right? You unlocked a button. Like,
So Pathfinder 2 does the antithesis of that. There is a kind of a choice that happens at every single level for most classes. I haven't played Pathfinder 2, but I've looked through its books, and generally, regardless of what class you're playing as, every level, there's some kind of choice between two or three options that's baked into your class that will deeply impact the way you play your character. And I, to be honest, kind of found myself getting overwhelmed a little bit going through that. Not like it was too much to handle, but just being like, I feel like I'm exhausted of making choices now. It's like the opposite of choice paralysis, where it's like, I know exactly what I want, but it's just getting a little dull at this point. I wonder if there's a good middle ground between finding that, you know, the simplicity and the streamlined elegance that it seems like D&D wants to go for, while also having that sort of finding a new present under the tree feeling of having a new choice to make every level.
By the way, Horrible Cabbage in chat has pulled up the rogue deets for us from the playtest. It says once on each of your turns when you take the attack action.
Yeah.
So basically once per round.
I don't hate that. Only because I have a
I do.
I can never remember the name of it. It's like the gunslinger or the outlaw subclass from the Grim Hollow Player's Guide in my party right now.
So one of yours.
And whenever they roll initiative, they can instantly use their reaction to make an attack.
Yes, and it's incredible. It's one of the coolest design things I've ever seen.
It is super cool, and it makes him feel super cool, but it also ends combats before they've started. It's just like, you know, shoot from the hip, dude is dead, all right, moving on sort of thing.
But with sneak attack once per turn, that would still be true, that on initiative you would still only get sneak attack like twice in that first round.
Yeah, that's still sneak attack twice in that first round.
So?
I
what kind of monsters are you building?
I am really struggling, to be honest, a little bit, because I've gone from like the way that I balance encounters has changed, where like young DM Ben, his brain was very like, if we roll for initiative and I'm going to draw it on the grid, it needs to be worth the time to like draw it on the grid, right? Which led to every encounter turning into like a potentially deadly encounter. And I was like, all right, I need to step back off that. I need to make encounters much easier. But now I'm running around, they're level 5, and I'm running around with a lot of bandits that have like 20 hit points, and then the big bad will have like 40, 60, 80 hit points, something like that. And it just feels like, yeah, they just snap off the 20 hit points little dudes very, very quickly and very, very effectively. And I'm like, oh, okay, there's some middle ground I've got to bring it back to somehow, because the balancing on 5e is weird. It feels like with the amount of hit points that the players have versus the amount of damage that they can put out.
Make some bad guys who have that class level. who are outlaw.
That's actually a good idea. Yeah, that's a good idea. Anyway, enough about that.
Sorry. no more rogues.
Anything else that we want to play out, either from this class or the playtest packet in general, that's changed?
I was thinking about how the channel divinity is like, I guess it's not substantially less than it was before. I don't know. There's something that feels a little bit weaker or less substantial about the paladin's channel divinity. And I've always been... I mean, this is perhaps not the most popular opinion. I'm not huge on paladins having channel divinity because it feels like channel divinity should be the cleric's like core feature. And the paladins already have that. They've got smite. So giving the paladins channel divinity as well feels like you're just cribbing from the cleric a little bit. So to me, at a certain point, if you're going to start pulling back on the channel divinity for the paladin, I say just get rid of it and replace it with something else that is more specific and, you know, paladin coolifying. This is language.
How do you feel about channel nature? Do you feel better about that?
Name sucks.
I was going to say I don't hate the name because I like that it divides the, you know, you've got this like divine magic, right? And it feels like for a long time, the druid has kind of just been shuffled into the divine caster category. And now that they're not, they're primal, right? I think that it's good to have something that signifies that they are not just clerics with wood armor. I don't love the name as a name necessarily, but I like what it represents.
When I saw that, I thought, why don't we just make Druid a subclass of cleric?
Yeah. Well, that's, you know,
and,
I think
and
maybe
make that channeling stuff, your shape change.
Now that is a cleric of nature.
We could call it something like nature domain.
Yeah, I think what you're reacting to there with the channel divinity, Dale, is potentially it feels watered down because divine sense doesn't feel like its own special bespoke thing for the paladin anymore. It feels like, I don't know, a cleric ability that is flavored differently for the paladin. And that's possibly semantics, but then that links with the druid having channel nature. And it's just like, okay, this ability feels... Yeah, exactly. This keywording feels like they're really trying to just, you know, watercolor these classes to be incredibly.
Is that?
Yeah.
Is it clerics, paladins, and druids who are that grouping? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I see.
Druids have always been kind of this priest of nature, and there has been a sort of divine bent to them, even back in the original. Who were the druids? IRL, you know, they were clerical people for a pagan faith.
They were clerical. They were crunching the numbers.
They were absolute paladins of
filing leaves.
What was Stonehenge but a very large abacus?
It's a calendar, really. That's all.
If we're going to need you to submit your timesheets to Stonehenge, mm-hmm. do that. That would be great.
Yes, grappling works better now. I am more satisfied that it's not based on armor class.
Oh, yeah. And I also quite like, I know I'm one of the people who thinks that none of the rules have changed with regards to what can interrupt a long rest. I feel like that's how I've always read it, but I do like that it's clearer now. Because, okay, to the people out there who are like, oh, having a short combat in the middle of a long rest shouldn't interrupt the long rest. All right, I don't know if you've ever had to get up at 2 a.m. to do battle with a huntsman, but it takes a long time to get to sleep afterwards, okay?
You don't feel rested.
No, you're putting your bed in the middle of the room and staring at all the walls with the lights on for a very long time afterwards. So I feel like if a group of people ambush me in the night intent on my death, that maybe it makes sense to add an extra hour to the end of the long rest.
That's if you can get to sleep at all with the adrenaline kind of pumping, you know.
I think these rules are very generous.
Dale, you know, I really thought you were making kind of an abstract reference. Like, so, you know, you're an adventurer in the wild and this rabid huntsman appeared intent on stabbing you with a hunting knife. No, you were talking about the giant, like, torso-sized spider that showed up in your room one time.
Yeah, not one time. Not one time, James.
We live with them.
Can't believe I didn't see a single one. There for 6 weeks, not one giant spider.
Oh, you missed out? I had one upstairs near where you were staying, in fact. He was waiting till you left. He's like, is he gone yet? All right, time to come out. He had his little hat on with the corks, and it was great.
A thong on each
foot. Yeah, exactly. Ardlings. Do we feel sad that the Ardling is gone? Didn't think so.
Which one was the Ardling?
The Ardling.
The animal-headed ones.
From the Beastlands.
I feel like they had improved the second time we saw them, but I'm not, like, sad.
Yeah, I thought they were neat, but maybe not core ancestry.
Yeah, that's where
meat.
I don't think anybody knew what they were or what they were meant to be. Or, you know, as Sean said in this very conversation, what need they were fulfilling. Except to say, if I was a cynical man, instead of making a tabaxi, an arakocra, a lizard folk, or whatever, let's just make one race or one heritage, one species where you could be any of those things that you want to be, and you just tell us what it is, but there's a unified rule set.
We're sick of making cat people and bird people. You make the cat person, bird person.
I do, you know, thinking about it, not from that cynical, mechanical, digital tool set sense, but from a story sense, I can see the advantageousness to making your animal people kind of a special thing, right? Every fantasy setting has a bird person and a cat person, et cetera, et cetera. But if you tie them to the planes of D&D, which are distinctly D&D, then all of a sudden you have this kind of through line that explains why, you know, there might be a tabaxi on Eberron or something like that. Why? It's because it's there a part of the greater cosmology from the Beastlands.
Mm. Hench on the Bench says it best, player character of the land. which is the most incredible thing I've ever heard. But it's also a good point, right? It's how close do we need our characters to be? And my question is, you know, I'm the old school gamer here, and I hear all of you saying like it's not the core. Who says what the core is?
Mm-hmm. Who decides the literary canon?
Right. I mean, yes, they haven't been in D&D forever, but why can't they be a 1D&D core? Mm-hmm. And is it just because, is that why they got the axe? Is that really what it came down to, was we haven't seen them before, so therefore off they go? Because I'm sad if that's why it happened. If it was because of some mechanical thing, or if it was because of a story thing, or okay. But if it was just because it's not something that should be in our first player's handbook, I want some change. I want to see something different. And so does my cat here, Beast of the Land.
I mean, to be, going off what Jeremy Crawford said on a recent D&D video where they were talking about this, he said, yeah, the reason that the Ardling got the axe is because nobody seemed to know what it was. Nobody, in his words, nobody had the context to be able to feel connected to it. And therefore the kind of feedback was really tepid, towards it. And so he said, look, this doesn't mean that the Ardling won't come back in a future iteration, in some, you know, expansion or something for 6E, because that's what it's going to be called. But it's not, you know, as we're saying, core, or it's not right now. It's not its time right now. And I see that point because, like, even the word Ardling, it's just a bunch of boring, soft consonants and vowels that evoke nothing, you know? Even Tabaxi, even though I wouldn't assume that's a cat person if I didn't have context, that at least feels there's something in the sound
tabaxi
of that.
Tabaxi.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly. Ardling is just like, what's an Ardling?
You know what? Sean has made me interrogate my own feelings for a minute. And I think part of it for me, and this is, it's weird because I do actually quite like the final Ardling that they landed on. I think I would be hyped to see it in a book as a new player. But it is this weird thing where it's like you come to a fantasy setting game for the first time, and there are certain things that you expect to see. You expect to see elves, dwarves, you know, maybe orcs. I don't know that you expect to see a dragonborn, but having dragon in the name helps, you know. It kind of all fits in this packet. And I think that part of it is that pop culture, so the Ardlings are a little bit Egyptian in vibe, you know, animal-headed people. And I think that pop culture has trained me to think of Egyptian-styled things as more sci-fi than fantasy. I think that's literally part of what it comes down to. I think it's strange little different spices being put in my fantasy pot over time.
D&D is such a weird melting pot, though, of like predominantly Western sort of culture, religions, mythologies, contexts, monsters, and all that sort of stuff. But it does have like weird. Sorry, let me phrase myself carefully here, because I don't intend to suggest that anything that's not Western is weird. What I mean to say is
how problematic is it that pop culture has trained me to think of Egyptian things as being sci-fi? You know what I mean? Like,
well, that's kind of where I'm going, is that we have these like, it's strange the way they're presented is what I mean when I say weird. These strange kind of break-ins of other monsters and creatures from other cultures that feel D&D because they've been in the game, you know, for a long time. But the game has trained you to think of something celestial as the Christianized, like, you know, feather-winged humanoid over what might be, you know, an animal-headed, you know, humanoid or something like that instead. And so I think that was part of people's confusion is literally the question I saw was, is this replacing the Arsimar? Is this, like, because they're saying that it fulfills some sort of celestial, some sort of otherworldly role, and yet is also, you know, very earthy and bestial as well at the same time.
And that's not even to get into how in old Forgotten Realms lore, the realms had canonical contact with mythic ancient Egypt.
Would you say it's forgotten?
Yeah, very forgotten.
Cool. All right. Well, we are starting to run up on time, but let us, with our final 5 minutes, just take a quick listener question who emailed. This is Graham's question. Graham emailed podcast@ghostfiregaming.com, which you can also email to get your question read out and have us answer it. This is a few weeks old. I apologize, Graham. I hope you've done well in your endeavor. But if you haven't started yet, undoubtedly we'll help you or other folks right now. Graham is asking how to teach new RPGs to players. What are some tips and tricks and techniques to use to
how to teach? Isn't Sean doing that with his class right now? Aren't they?
A little bit. Yeah, a little bit. So here's the one big piece of advice I have, and the one don't do it, even though it sounds cool. The piece of advice is tell the players what the game expects them to do. So if the game expects them to hit monsters with swords and spells and take away their hit points until they're dead, although that's not cool, the cool thing to say, tell them that that's what they're going to do. Because how do a lot of people introduce it to players? They say, in this game, you can do anything you want. And then combat starts and the player says, well, I want to do this thing. And it has nothing to do with them hitting it with their sword if they're a fighter or casting a spell at it if they're a wizard. And then you have to backtrack and say, well, yes, you could do that. But really what you're best at are these seven things or these two things. And really, this is what we're trying to do. And so you're starting out with the big lie, which is you can do anything. When you really can't, the game expects you to do certain things. So tell the players what those things are right at the start. Then get into the, you can also branch out and do other things as well. But this is probably what you're going to be doing if you are playing the game like the game expects itself to be played.
Not quite as snappy a tagline, is it?
No.
We got to come up with a new one. You can do anything that the game expects.
You can do anything your character sheet says.
This game meets your expectations.
What do you do then as the marketing person if it doesn't? Danger. Pray. Danger, Will Robinson.
Oh, go ahead.
Sorry, yeah. No. You go, Sean.
Nice. So I feel like I'm like the big downer this episode, but like all these awkward questions, all of these things that we either push off to the side or ignore about games in our joy of playing them, not recognizing the rough spots or the flaws is one of the things that makes it hard to pass on to new players. So that's why it's always good to, warts and all, get it out there and say, you know, this is some of the problems that we might have. Here are ways to get around them. Here's how the game helps us smooth over these rough patches that a narrative storytelling back and forth game brings up on occasion. So that's one why it's important to, you know, speak truth to game, if you will, to make it easier to translate this experience to what the players are already know and will come to learn as they're playing.
And Sean, I think that's what makes this podcast different from marketing, right? It's hard to make nerd news different from marketing because so much of the time it's just a product release. But having our ability to look at things and not just talk about the shiny coat of paint, but look at the fundamental issues and approach it in a, you know, in an honest way, not a hater way, but an honest mm-hmm. way is what makes us really good.
I'm a hater.
Dale, no. You can be a hater. We have room for haters on this show.
Every panel needs the mean judge, right? No.
Yes.
But no, I think Sean is giving some really important insight here. And I think it's why something like, you know, Critical Role as a Life Play is such a huge boon for a game like 5th edition Dungeons & Dragons over other tabletop RPGs, is having a prominent, well, like, produced show that gives you how the rules work. You can watch and absorb the rules as you go. Oh, it's easy. I roll a d20 and I add some numbers together, right? And higher numbers is good, you know, that sort of a thing. But at the same time, it's also a cast of people who both understand the expectations of the game. They understand that a lot of it is, you know, fighting, casting spells, all those things. But it's also a cast who have reached a point where they branch a little bit beyond that. And so they play mm-hmm. into the role play aspects. They, you know, make creative choices with spells, things like that. And I think that it's why D&D at the moment has such an easy sort of funnel to get players into the game, because you can watch it and just go, oh, this is what the game wants from me. Mm. And you know what? It's what I want from the game. And I'm excited for a potential future where we get that kind of a thing for lots more other games as well.
For sure. Cool. Well, speaking of this podcast, it is time to end it for another week. Doesn't matter, Dale, whatever.
Nothing matters. It's fine.
Speaking of games, the game that is this podcast has ended for another week. No. All right.
It's a valiant effort.
Speaking of Dale, you can catch Dale next week on Great. Another episode of the Eldritch Lorecast.
It's true. Barring some horrendous accident.
Well, cross our fingers now and touch wood that a horrendous accident, or I don't know, just an appointment that you have to go to, doesn't come up.
Roll off the tongue either.
Definitely a horrendous accident. Definitely.
Call the marketing folks. Let's workshop this.
We got a review.
In all seriousness, I can see we've had quite a few first-time chatters in the Twitch chat today. Welcome. We're glad you're here. And if you're listening to this on YouTube or through the audio platforms such as Spotify, welcome if you're a new listener. We are here every week. You can find us on YouTube on Ghostfire Podcast, or if you just search the Eldritch Lorecast. We're on Ghostfire_official on Twitch. We're lots of places. So come check us out and hang out, because it's fun and honest, good, honest, hearty, down-to-earth tabletop RPG news and
podcast of discussion. The land, as they're saying in chat.
Exactly.
Podcast of the people.
I like that better. All right, my name's been Ben Byrne, and it will continue to be so. And I've been here with Dale Kingsmill, Sean Merwin, James Hake, and we will catch you next week.
This week on the Eldritch Lorecast. All that and more, right now! I need just a second. Oh no, I was doing karate. Like Power Rangers moves. Okay, wait, I got tears. Alright, can I ask, this one with or without the karate? Just a normal one.